Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 5th, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Well. I'm doing well. I'm glad to hear you're well. I'm glad to hear you survived the blizzard of 2015. It was a lot of snow last week, huh?
Absolutely. It just seems to never end, basically.
So tell me, is a big snowstorm proof that global warming does not exist?
Well, the deniers would have you believe that, but obviously people who actually know science understand that there is, in fact, an overlap between climate change and extreme weather events, including snowstorms. There was an interesting and, I thought, sadly, a bit of a convoluted piece in the February 5th edition of the Boston Globe, in which Paul O'Gorman, an associate professor of atmospheric science at MIT, described a recent study he conducted, pointing to the connection between climate change and extreme weather events such as snowstorms. Obviously, you know, the more carbon pollution you put into the atmosphere, you end up with a situation where there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, and when
that's because warm air holds more water vapor. It's more humid
exactly.
In summertime, right? Yeah,
exactly. And as a result, when you have cold days, you will have an onslaught of snow. Just as when you have slightly warmer days, you will have an onslaught of rain.
Mm-hmm.
My only concern with the piece is that it was sort of a very, very lengthy and protracted explanation. I thought to myself, you know, this needs to be explained in a nutshell, so to speak. And I went back to a great segment that the former MSNBC host Keith Olbermann put on about 5 years ago this month. It was actually on February the 10th, 2010, after a large snowstorm in D.C., and where he explained it in literally two or three sentences. What happens when the Earth warms up? More water evaporates from the oceans like steam, meaning for those places where it's still below freezing, there will be more snow. The National Weather Service has confirmed this by saying that 2010 was the snowiest winter on record for Washington so far, unquote. So I figured that was a very effective way of explaining the concept and an effective way of refuting this argument that snowstorms disprove climate change, when extreme snowstorms are in fact one of the many things that prove climate change.
Yeah, I guess you make me think of the book by E.B. White about the elements of style.
Yes, right?
In terms of writing, he would say simplify, simplify, simplify. That was his, his mantra. So I guess you boiled a very long newspaper article down to three sentences. Good for you. But tell me, DR, there were, in the aftermath of the snowstorm, to my understanding, there were certainly horrible delays on the highway because the highways were all narrower, the traffic was bad, but the trains also had problems, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were enormous public transportation delays and numerous issues, and it raised the issue of the problems with aging infrastructure and the need to prepare infrastructure to deal with extreme weather events.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting.
Just what you're saying, and what I understand is that the switch lines on the tracks that the MBTA uses for its commuter rail, all that kind of stuff, is old and susceptible to really bitter cold. I mean, you can get through snow pretty good, but the cold just makes it fail. And so you have people standing on outside for 2 hours waiting for a train because they haven't kept up with the infrastructure protection, right?
Not just extreme cold, but also extreme heat, because whenever we get to June and July, there are always warnings saying that they have to run the trains slower because of the problems that occur with extreme heat and the effect they have on the infrastructure. So it actually prompted an interesting discussion, I believe, on the website bluemassgroup.com, in which one of the people in the comment sections noted that this may be one of the rationales for, in fact, bringing the Olympics to Boston, that this will force improvements in the infrastructure of public transportation. And I never thought of that argument before, but I have to admit there is some merit to that argument.
Don't get me going. Let's stay away from the Olympics. I think if we need to adapt to changing climates, if we need to worry about flood protection, if we need to fix the trains up, we got to do it on their own. But I heard something, DR, in terms of global adaptation, that the World Bank, of course, which no, it's not, yeah, the World Bank, they loan money to typically less developed countries, that they are going to forgive some loans. In fact, they're going to forgive loans to the countries in West Africa that had the Ebola virus because they were so hard hit. They're going to forgive some of that loans, but that money would then have to be spent on public infrastructure, and they were going to make other loans to countries that were hit by extreme weather events. And they didn't actually say climate, but they said, well, if you have a say an earthquake, that's not a weather event, but if you have a hurricane or something like that, the World Bank would be there to help, which is, in a sense, climate adaptation. So maybe those guys are a little bit ahead of the curve.
Exactly, and it just goes to show you once again that, with the exception of the obvious special interests, there are big institutions that are paying serious attention to this issue, and they recognize the economic and human rights implications of this problem.
So we've got a couple minutes left here on this topic. We want to switch from the adaptation issue, which is, fixing up the aging trains for hot weather, and move to the mitigation idea, which is to reduce carbon emissions in the first place. And there was an article in the paper that said MIT, some folks at MIT were working on a cheaper way to implement this concept of carbon sequestration, right?
Yes, there was a very interesting piece in the February 2nd edition of the Boston Globe describing MIT's efforts to try to get carbon capture and sequestration working in a cost-effective fashion. It's interesting that this piece was published just a few days before the announcement that the Obama administration was abandoning a George W. Bush-era effort to promote carbon capture and sequestration on the grounds that it was not cost-effective. And it's caused a very funny online meme in which people point out that there is already a guaranteed very low cost way to capture and sequester carbon, and that is to plant trees.
Exactly. Photosynthesis, what a wonderful thing. But just for the for folks who are listening who may not be conversant with the concept of carbon capture and sequestration, the basic idea is that if you have a coal-powered plant generating electricity, the smokestack at which all the emissions are going out is where all the carbon dioxide goes through. So you have this one chance where all the carbon dioxide is sort of concentrated in a column going up the chimney. If you could somehow capture that carbon, you would take it away and quote unquote sequester it, that is to say, pump it underground somewhere and hold it there for hopefully forever, right? So that's the pipe dream. And the problem has been to actually capture the carbon dioxide because it's a gas, it's a hot gas going up the chimney. How do you sort of pull the carbon dioxide out of that flow of gas in a cost-effective way so you can bury it underground? And the MIT guys think they have a way to reduce that cost somewhat, but I agree with you and I agree with the president that literally a pipe dream is pretty much the right analogy because all that gas is going up the pipe and it's very hard to capture it. So there you go with adaptation and mitigation here. Some interesting work at MIT. Wish them well. It would be a nice thing if it worked, but we'll have to see. So tell me, Dia, then there was the other big event of the week. Not event, the other big kerfuffle, right? The other big media melee, as we might say. Turns out Chris Christie was asked about whether or not people should get vaccinations for their kids, right? And then this whole media circus ensued. So tell me, what should I think about it? What's your take on the whole bit, especially as it pertains to the obvious parallel to climate change?
Yeah, so it was a huge controversy that emerged earlier this week when New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, in a visit to Cambridge, England, implied that it should be optional whether or not parents should get their kids vaccinated for serious diseases. And then from there, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky also implied that it probably should be optional to get vaccinations for serious diseases such as measles. It has caused a tremendous backlash, and Christie and Paul, to various degrees, started backpedaling from their statements. And it also exposed this sort of
And just to say, I mean, much of the backlash came from within sort of the mainstream part of the Republican Party, right?
Yes, that's correct, and also from commentators, particularly from the right of center side of the spectrum, most notably Fox News Channel personality Shepard Smith and Megyn Kelly, the latter of whom said that sometimes Big Brother is right and sometimes things have to be done for the public good.
Well, I gotta cut in there and say, okay, so here is sort of this bastion of hyper individualism at Fox. One of their people saying that sometimes acting in service of the community or taking an action to for the greater good is the right thing to do. How come they can't connect that to climate change? How come they can't see that our collective action to address climate is not the right thing to do? I mean, why the distinction?
That's a very interesting question. You'd like to think that the issue in terms of vaccination doesn't sort of activate the sort of ideological triggers that climate change seems to activate with regard to some commentators. But as it turns out, in fact, in some cases, it does activate similar triggers because in the Washington Post story about this issue of vaccination, they quoted a gentleman I knew of, I believe his name is Nick Gillespie, who is a writer for a libertarian magazine known as Reason Magazine, which is known to be funded by the notorious Charles and David Koch. And Nick Gillespie indicated that there is a vigorous debate among some elements of the public regarding whether or not the government should mandate their use, and that Christie may have been trying to curry favor with that segment of the electorate that has this sort of libertarian ideological opposition to government-mandated vaccines.
Although, truth be told, there are a lot of, my understanding is that there's a lot of sort of liberal democratic enclaves out on the West Coast, well-to-do places where the kids are not vaccinated because the people, I don't know, they have some concern about that, right?
There have been allegations to that effect, although there was an interesting post on February 2nd by Ed Kilgore of the Washington Monthly, who said that while there may be some people on the progressive side of the aisle who have that sort of reservation about vaccines, if you look at the history of sort of rebellion against government efforts to promote public health, most notably the long-standing controversy over putting fluoride in the water, that tends to be from the more reactionary side of the political spectrum, and that this is what Chris Christie and Rand Paul may have been playing to.
So I guess it's an interesting thing about the fluoridation, because you're right, that has been going on since the 1950s. And curiously enough, maybe 18 months ago, I heard a local candidate here in my town talking about fluoridation. Question is, it rank conspiracy? I mean, conspiracy theories are very attractive to people, right? Because they can't really explain it, but it explains a lot of stuff. Is that the driver, or is it an ideological opposition to government action, where your ideology, the idea in your head, trumps reality? How do people get, I mean, you mentioned before that there was opposition to tobacco. And the funny one, DR, you're great, but I mean, you were talking about the seatbelt thing in the 1970s, right? There were people here opposing seatbelt laws because it was going to crush their individual freedom. Same thing with motorcycle helmets, right? where does that stuff come out? I mean, it's a balance between conspiracy theory and this feeling of not being bossed around or something.
It goes to something that Peter Sinclair has been writing about on his great website, Climate Denial Croc of the Week, where you know certain interests that didn't particularly like the economic implications of science then started putting out these sorts of libertarian memes, and they put a lot of money out behind these libertarian memes, and now these memes have gotten out of control, and it's led to denial of the link between tobacco and cancer, denial of the link between carbon emissions and global warming, and now even to denying the logic of government mandations for vaccines. It just seems to have gotten out of control.
But I think
Seems
then
to have become
you
completely
almost
illogical.
fall prey to the conspiracy theory too. I mean, the Koch brothers. I mean, I was going to say that there is no big money behind the vaccine meme, right? This sort of at least I don't see it in the same way as climate. But there's this rejection of science, and. I hate to say libertarian because I'm not really sure, but a rejection of a responsibility to the community that these people have in common with the fluoridation. Of course, the seatbelt thing is clearly individual liberty, right? There's not much beyond that other than the seatbelt lobby, I suppose. But I mean, it's an interesting thing. It's hard to unpack the parallels, comparing and contrasting this whole thing about vaccination, where people don't accept the science, and climate change, where people don't accept the science and have some wacky conspiracy theory floating around in the background. Have I
It also
sufficiently mixed up all the concepts there? I mean.
I think it ultimately goes back to a certain anti-government sentiment, and Tom Hartman was discussing this. The radio host Tom Hartman was discussing this earlier this week, putting it in the context of other efforts to promote the public good, and this sort of ideological rejection of efforts to promote the public good on the grounds that they somehow infringe upon liberty. What we're dealing with, I think, is this sort of radical and illogical interpretation of liberty, to where people define liberty as the right to harm themselves and others. It's the same motivating factor that I had mentioned with regard to the effort to try to undo laws mandating seatbelt use in Massachusetts, which was temporarily successful in the 1980s, but it was later reversed. This whole idea that I have the right to hurt myself and I have the right to damage your lungs with secondhand smoke. I have the right to burn leaves on my lawn and mess up your air, that sort of thing. It's this
Give
sort
you a
of
kid
radical
measles.
interpretation.
Right.
Exactly. And it's this sort of ultra-libertarianism, which is odd, but which, as we've seen, happens to be a factor in our culture.
Well, I guess the take-home lesson for me is, and for climate hawks, is that the whole vaccine, all of these top, the vaccine thing, the seatbelt thing, all these things come down to a concept of, do you believe that we must act as a community in our mutual self-interest, or do you believe that we are all atomic individuals who have no interaction and no responsibility to each other? And I think as climate hawks, the one of the core things is that we are all on the same planet together and have to find a way to live here in community. And maybe that's the take-home lesson from the vaccine debacle of the last week, huh?
No man is an island.
No man is an island. Well, DR, we got to put this down here. I want to thank you for chatting. I want to tell folks that they can check out the links to most of what we've discussed at the blog. It's a WordPress blog, massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave a comment there. You can find us on Facebook. It's /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher. And of course, you can find us on iTunes by simply searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. We are unique in that way. No problem finding us. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity for personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.